morning, everyone. He said, without further ado, but has there been any previous ado? All right. What I want to encourage everyone, being as this is the last message in our Open Door series, is two things. Just keep praying and asking God to open doors for you. Let's not let this be a season that passes. Let's keep it up. Let's let it be a lifestyle. Number two, if you get a chance, listen to either one of Donnie Griggs' messages, the one he spoke here about 3 weeks ago, or the one he spoke at Global on Friday morning. They're excellent messages that will really equip you. I want to start out by looking at a verse in 1 Peter 3:15 that Peter wrote to a church that was under persecution, and they were, the beginning of the letter says, to the exiles. And when we see that word exile, we don't want to just quickly pass over it. That's a very loaded term. It represents real trauma, actually, that these people have been, because of persecution, torn from their home, torn from their village, and they're living, this particular case, they're like 200-300 miles north of where they were because of Nero's persecution that was really ramping up. This is about the year 65 AD. And here they are in this foreign land, strangers in a strange land. And let's listen to what Peter writes to them, at least just in this verse. But in your hearts, honor Christ as Lord, as holy, always being prepared or ready to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. And just notice how Peter is pastoring them. They're in a tough situation. They're being persecuted. And he's not saying, you know, pull back, retreat. Don't have any contact with people that might persecute you or hassle you. He's encouraging to stay engaged, stay in the fight, continue to be a light. And he's doing that because he knows that's what's best for them. That will bring about God's best. It's not going to be easy, but that's going to bring about God's best. So as we look at this verse, you know, I know there's a vast array of people in this room that have different feelings towards messages about personal evangelism. Let's just approach this verse with a prayer in our heart that's something like this. Jesus, because I love you, I want to share your love with others. Help me. I want to be like the people in this verse, but I need your help to do it. And if we can just keep that prayer in our hearts, I know God will help us. So let's look at the verse closely. First thing he says is, in your hearts. You know, as Sue came up, she said, this has to flow out of our hearts. God never asks us to do something unless he has worked in our hearts first. And if you're a believer, he has worked in your hearts, and this will flow out of it. In your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy. Like, what position does he have in your heart? Is he sitting kind of in the background, or is he sitting on the throne of your heart? So that's number one. Number two, always be ready or always be prepared. Just talks, there's no mystery here, what it's saying here. Be ready. You know, there's a good exercise. I want to just do this right now. Ask yourself this. If somebody were to come up to you and say, what is the reason that you're a Christian? Do you have an answer readily available? Are you ready? Be ready. Always be ready. Number two, be ready for what? To make a defense. A defense is a clear case for the faith. A defense is a reasonable, logical answer. Now, you know your audience too. You know, some people want more of an analytical, kind of theological reason. Some people want just a bare bones, basic, you know, down to earth, which probably is most of the time. But know your audience so that you can communicate this and give them a reason. And don't speak Christianese. Does everybody know what Christianese is? You know, speak in a language where they can understand it. Number four, to anyone who asks you. Now, this assumes that these believers are in relationship with unbelievers. And that these unbelievers are going to look at them and they're going to ask them, what is it about the hope that is in you? So that, I think, is a real problem in the church today, that we become Christians and we just lose contact with our unbelieving friends, and we just lose contact. That's not good. We got to fix that. We got to change that. Find ways to engage with unbelievers and develop relationships with them. Not just the one and done, just develop, because it takes a long time, but find ways to do that. And what do they ask for? The reason for the hope that is in us. Peter is assuming that this hope, which is in here, was visible. You know, these strangers, these unbelievers, were going to notice something. And they were going to say, what is it about that? You're being persecuted, but there's something about you. What is it? I want to know. It's compelling. And then lastly, with gentleness and respect. You know, a lot of times people aren't won over by what we say, but how we say it. Yeah. You know, if we communicate our love and care for them. I think we've all probably heard this, but nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. So what this verse is describing is something we call Christian apologetics. Has anybody heard that term, apologetics? Yeah. All right, good. It's not the art of telling somebody how sorry you are for becoming a Christian. Apologetics in this verse, it comes from a Greek word, apologia, and it just means defense. So apologetics is making a defense for the truth of the Christian faith. Now I want to share some things with you this morning that I hope will build your confidence in sharing the hope that is in you. Our problem here is we live in a very skeptical culture, and people are, you know, the enemy is just working overtime to continue to perpetrate this lie that Christians are fools that have checked their brains at the door and have no evidence for their faith. We have evidence for our faith. Listen to this. This is by Dr. William Lane Craig. And just by way of resource, just YouTube anything by William Lane Craig and click on a video of him, and you're going to learn something. It's well worth your while. He says this: if the gospel is to be heard as an intellectually viable option for thinking men and women today, then it is vital that we as Christians try and shape American culture in such a way that Christian belief cannot be dismissed as mere superstition. This is where Christian apologetics comes in. If Christians can be trained to give solid evidence for what they believe and good answers to unbelievers' questions and objections, then the perceptions of Christians would slowly change. Christians would be seen as thoughtful people to be taken seriously, not as emotional fanatics or buffoons. The gospel would be a real alternative for people to embrace. And then he goes on, I'm not saying that people will become Christians because of the arguments and the evidence. Rather, I'm saying that the arguments and the evidence will create a culture in which Christian belief is a reasonable thing. They create an environment in which people will be open to the gospel. So this morning, I'm going to give you three short apologetics on three topics. You know, books and books and books have been written about these. I'm just going to touch the top of the waves and try and cover them in about 5 minutes each. But the first one is the bodily resurrection of Jesus. Second one is the reliability of the gospel. And the third one is the problem of suffering. Because these often come up, I don't know about you, but these often come up when I'm sharing the gospel with somebody, and they're really being critical, and really they've thought it through. There's people that have really thought it through and have really strong arguments against the faith, and you got to be prepared. The resurrection, that's the first one. Now, folks, we always hear about the resurrection of Jesus. It's a very common term to us, but I don't know if we realize the impact of the resurrection. No single act in human history has had more of an effect on mankind than the resurrection. It's the linchpin of our faith. And when I say that, I'm not demeaning the cross of Christ, because the gospel, You know, there was a preacher that used to say, I could share the gospel in one hand. Jesus died for my sins. And he was a friend of mine, so I said, you know, you only share half the gospel. Because the gospel is Jesus died for my sins and Jesus rose from the dead. It's in 1 Corinthians 15:3. And the thing is, Paul said this, if Jesus hasn't risen from the dead, your faith is in vain. I mean, it's all just throw in the towel. So it's the resurrection is the linchpin. It's the pivot point of our faith. Tim Keller says this, if Jesus hasn't been raised from the dead, we don't have to listen to anything he said. You know, because there have been plenty of would-be messiahs that have come and gained a following, and then they died, and that was the end of it. And if Jesus didn't raise from the dead, he would be one of those. As a matter of fact, William Lane Craig was asked to give an interview with the LA Times. This is around the time of the Passion of the Christ came out. And so this interviewer wanted to talk to him about the Passion of the Christ. And he said to the interviewer, aren't you going to ask me about the resurrection? And she said, no, just the Passion, you know, just the before that. And he goes, well, if there wasn't a resurrection, we wouldn't even be here. Right? So anyway, Tim Keller said, if Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, then we don't have to listen to anything he said. But if he was raised from the dead, we have to listen to everything he said. And not only we, but our world has to hear that also. So I'm going to give you a quick overview of the evidence we have today that could show that 2,000 years ago, Jesus rose from the dead. I'm going to talk about these three facts, the empty tomb, the belief that the apostles that the risen Jesus appeared to them, and the growth of the church. Now, these are facts. I call these facts, scholars call these facts. These aren't just from the Bible. These are widely attested facts from believers and unbelievers alike in the academic community of New Testament scholarship. In other words, there's religion departments in colleges all over this country, even, you know, secular colleges, and they're filled with theologians, scholars that aren't even believers, believe it or not, but they attest to these here, and that's why we can call them facts. So the first one, the empty tomb. And again, I like I say, there's books written on these. I'm just going to briefly give a couple points. Because, you know, when the apostles, look, it's either true. The resurrection is either true or it's a fabrication. There's nothing in between. Jesus was died and was buried in Jerusalem in Joseph's tomb. So his location was known to Christian and non-Christian alike. The disciples started their preaching in Jerusalem. They started going around saying Jesus rose from the dead. Now, if they falsely believed it, if it was a fabrication, and they were lying, and they were preaching that Jesus rose from the dead, their story could be easily debunked by anybody just going to the tomb of Jesus and seeing that his body still lay there. But that hasn't happened because his body wasn't there. Number two, the empty tomb was discovered by women first. Now, in Jewish and Greek culture, women were not considered reliable sources. And so if the disciples were going to make up a story that everybody would believe, they wouldn't put in there that women were the first to discover it. And number three, early enemy attestation. In other words, what have the enemies said about the empty tomb? And over the years, there have been these theories to explain the empty tomb other than the resurrection. So in other words, they're not denying the empty tomb. They're saying, yeah, there was an empty tomb, but this is why. So first we have this conspiracy theory that the disciples stole the body. Next we have the wrong tomb theory. And these are put forth by serious secular theologians. These are not just somebody said something on the internet. These are, a lot of time and effort went into these things. The wrong tomb theory, where the women, when they went to the tomb, they got lost and they went to the wrong tomb and they ended up at an empty tomb. So they went back and told everybody the tomb is empty. Another one is the displaced body theory. Joseph of Arimathea only placed Jesus in the tomb for one night, But then the next day he took him out and put him in a kind of a common tomb. And so when the women went there, they saw an empty tomb. And the last one was the apparent death theory. I think Eric mentioned this one on Easter. Jesus wasn't really dead. He was only mostly dead.
Look who knows so much, huh? Well, it just so happens that your friend here is only mostly dead. There's a big difference between mostly dead and all dead. Please open his mouth. Now, mostly dead is slightly alive. Now, all dead, well, with all dead, there's usually only one thing that you can do.
What's that?
Go through his clothes and look for loose change.
I brought that up, yeah, for a laugh, but also just to show you the lengths people will go through to deny what is really true about the resurrection. So those are just three on the empty tomb. Next, the belief of the disciples that the risen Jesus appeared to them. One guy might die for a lie. You know, if they were lying, well, maybe one guy might die because he's a little, maybe mentally off a little bit. But would like 10 or 11, I mean, tradition tells us that pretty much every one of the disciples died for their faith. Now, is that even rational? That is not rational. That is so unlikely. Number two, the story of Jesus' appearances to the 12, if it was a fabrication, that means that they would have had to get together and make a pact about this, like the day after Jesus died, and then begin to perpetrate that on Easter morning. But that is very unlikely for these reasons. Number one, they had nothing to gain from it except persecution and death. Number two, a personal resurrection is foreign to Jewish theology. The Jews believed that, yeah, all Jews were going to raise from the dead at the end of the age, but no Jew believed that one person would resurrect before that. So if the disciples wanted to fabricate a story that other Jews would believe, it would not be this story unless it was true. And then lastly, the growth of the church is evidence that Jesus rose from the dead. Why? I mean, we're here. We're here this morning. Why are we here? We're here because those disciples in the middle of the first century gave their life to tell the story that Jesus rose from the dead, and that story spread like wildfire. Christianity changed the world. Now, could that be because 12 uneducated guys put a story together? Highly unrational. They say at the end of the first century, there are about 4,000 Christians. In the year 300, in the year of Constantine, historians tell us there was about 6 million Christians. Today in the world, there's 2.6 billion Christians. Now, we know that everybody that says they're a Christian isn't the Christian as we see it in the Bible. But let's cut that in half and say 1.3 billion Christians. Based on a lie and a vision, based on a fabrication, based on the story of 12 uneducated guys, completely irrational. One more, Tim Keller. He said, the onus is on the skeptic to provide an explanation for the growth of the church other than the resurrection. This is an obvious fact that cannot be ignored. I'm going to move on to the reliability of the New Testament. If we ourselves are not confident in the reliability of the Gospels, or if the skepticism of the world has crept into our thinking about the Bible, it's going to hinder our ability to share the gospel. So it's important that we understand that the Bible we have is true to the original writings. So I'm just going to give you a brief description of how we got the Bible and then answer three common objections to it. For the sake of the time, I'm just going to focus on the Gospels. We know that Matthew, Mark, and Luke were all written originally about the second half of the first century, and then John was written sometime around the turn of the century, maybe as late as 125 AD. All right, when the Gospels were written and circulated to the churches, they were copied. And then they were passed on, and some, you know, another church would copy. Then copies of those copies were made. And then copies of the copies of the copies were made. And you get the idea. It was just constantly being copied. Today, we don't have the originals, and we don't have any of the first, second, and third generation of those copies. They've disintegrated, basically. And so you're probably thinking yourself right now, how do we know what we have is true to the original? And that's a good question. Here's part of an explanation. Scholars believe that the New Testament manuscripts, to be the most frequently copied and widely distributed books of antiquity. The abundance of scriptural manuscript copies have made it possible to reconstruct the original text with virtually complete accuracy. The authenticity of the New Testament text we have today rest on the foundation of a massive amount of historical documentation. So what is that massive amount of historical documentation? Today we have 5,800 early manuscripts of the New Testament written in Greek. There's actually another 20,000 early copies, you know, back from the first, second, third century, that were written in Latin and Syriac and other languages. But I'm just going to focus on the Greek. We have 5,800 manuscripts. As far as the number of copies and the early dating of the copies, the Bible is far superior than some of our most popular writings in antiquity. Now, what do I mean, and why does that mean anything to us? Is there that chart? Yeah, just quickly, I want to go over this. I'm just going to take Caesar's Gallic war there. That's just an example. There's many, many examples like this. It was written in 50 BC. The oldest copy we have is from 850 AD. So there's a 900-year gap between when it was written and the earliest copy we have of that. And how many copies do we have? We have 10. Now look at the Gospels, written between 50 and 125 AD. So the oldest copies we have are maybe around 150 AD. Actually, there's some segments and pieces and pages that are earlier. They actually found something that was in the late first century, a page of the Gospel of John. So anyway, maybe a 100-year gap between when it was originally written and the earliest copies we have. And look how many. Now, why does the number mean so much? Because we can take all of those and line them all up. And if let's say we have 100 pages of part of the Gospel of John, and we find all of those that we have of that page, and let's say we have 100 of them, for example. If 99 of them say one thing, and one of them says something a little different, well, what's correct? It's the 99. That's why it's so important to have so many of them. You also might ask, we have so many manuscripts floating around the world. Are they all the same? And actually, the answer to that is no, they're not all the same. But the differences are what theologians call textual variances. Most of those have to do with spelling. You know, there was no dictionaries back then. So spelling was really up to the scribe. A lot of them have to do with grammar, stuff like that. Bart Ehrman, who is a expert in this field, he teaches New Testament at the University of North Carolina. He's not a believer. He's actually written some books, some confrontational books, kind of against traditional Christianity. But he is an expert in this field, and he said this: essential Christian beliefs are not affected by the textual variances in the manuscripts. So if somebody says they're all different or there's, you know, contradictions, you don't have to believe them. Here's three common objections. Of course, the first one is the Bible has contradictions. People will always say that to you. If they do, I would just, in a nice, kind way, because we're doing this, remember what the scripture said, with gentleness and respect. He said, I would love to know where that is. Can you please show me? And usually they'll just say that because that's what they heard. For the most part, they haven't looked into it. So That's that one. The Bible has contradictions. And then, of course, the next one is the Bible was written by man. And to that, just you can just calmly say, you are absolutely right. The Bible was written by man. Now, tell me, what is your problem with that? And they'll say something like, well, you know, man always corrupts stuff and adds stuff in and stuff. And you can kind of say, you know, you're right. They do that. Can you show me where they've done that in here? They probably wouldn't be able to. Yeah, and you could tell them this also. You can say, pretty much everything a person knows, they've learned from a man or a woman. Or they've read it from something written by a man and a woman. So just because something is written by man doesn't disqualify it. Now, it's probably not the time to get into what we know as the inspiration of Scripture, men moved by God. It's because they're just throwing stuff at you. But if you can stay in the conversation with gentleness and respect, it may move closer to the gospel. And then finally, the Bible has been copied so many times, it has become inaccurate, like the telephone game, right? Who's heard of that one, right? Well, it is like the telephone game, but with one additional rule, and that's this. The Bible, you know, the telephone game, you know, you got like 10 people, and the message goes all the way to the last person. And then here's the rule. The last person goes all the way back to the first person and corrects what he has based on what the first person said. That's really what Bible translation is all about. So the Bible we have today is true to what the original writings were. And then lastly, I want to talk about God and suffering. We often hear this, there's so much evil in the world, how can I believe there's a God? Have you heard that? Now, I'm going to give you a kind of a philosophical answer here, but only normally I don't want you to do that if somebody says that. We want to find out, why is this person saying that? You know, did they just have a mother die, a child die? Did they just get a diagnosis of cancer? You know, it's very important that, you know, you can give information, but our goal is to win them over to Christ, to be sensitive to the Spirit, and to speak as the Lord leads us. So if somebody says that, we want to know why they're asking that question. Now, for the antagonist, and you can tell, there's people that are just throwing stuff at us to trip us up. There's a good answer for that. If there's evil in the world, how can there be a God? I would first ask them, how do you determine what good is and what evil is if there is no God? This is what true atheism really believes, because this is a quote by Richard Dawkins. He's the premier, foremost new atheist of our day. You often see him debating Christians, or he's on college campuses, denigrating Christianity. He really has a vendetta against Christianity. And this is what he wrote. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at the bottom, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pointless indifference. So he is right. If there's no God, there's no right or wrong. And there's no evil. But we know there's evil. And if there is evil, there has to be good. And if we can make judgments on what is good and what is evil, then there must be a moral law. And if there's a moral law, there's a moral lawgiver, and that is God. So evil is actually proof that there is a God, not that there isn't a God. Second point here is that God could have created a world with no choice for evil. But that would also mean that there's no choice for love. In other words, God gave us free will. And in that free will, we can choose good or we can choose evil. Now, God didn't create evil, but by giving us free will, it allowed for the possibility of evil to be chosen. We can choose love and we can freely choose evil. To create a world without evil would also mean a world without love. But God created us with free will, to choose love because he is love, and love is greater than evil. So that brings us to this point. There is suffering and evil in the world, and God exists. Now, how does that help us? And how does that help the hurting person? It helps this way. Jesus said, in the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. It's just a normal part of everyday living for believer and unbeliever alike. But here's the difference. Only Christianity makes sense of and gives meaning to suffering. Look, we all are going to experience suffering, but only Christianity makes sense of and gives meaning to suffering. Now, in order to realize that, you have to realize also this one truth. And this could be a real kind of paradigm shift for some of us. God's chief purpose for man is not his happiness. His chief purpose for man is found in Romans 8:29. For those he foreknew, he also predestined to come to become conformed to the image of his son. God wants to conform you to the image of Jesus. He wants to make you like Jesus. Once we know this, we can accept suffering, and it takes on a whole different meaning. I was just going to close. I had 5 points here of what I have found, why I have found that suffering can be good. But I just really want to talk about one of them. Some of you might have heard me in some of my sermons talk about this period in my 3-year period in my life where it was the most challenging three years of my life. And it was kind of a lot of things were going wrong, had a lot of financial ramifications. I was trying to start a business, we were raising our family, and it was just kind of like every day I was just kind of being beat down a little more. And what got me through that was during that suffering, I clung to these verses, these promises from Jesus. Cast your cares upon me, for I care for you. And I said, Jesus, I know you don't say things, you only say things that you mean, and I have to cast this care upon you. I would wake up and just didn't want to be awake because I just had to deal with this stuff going on. And all I could do was cast my care upon Jesus. And he would take that burden. And I tell you, even though it was the most challenging 3 years of my life, it was the most rewarding because I met Jesus in that suffering. He walked with me every day. He took my burden. I know in this room, there's people that are suffering. And, you know, nowhere in Scripture it says God's going to deliver us from suffering. He's going to keep us from suffering. But many places in Scripture, he said he's going to be with us in our suffering. He's always with us. Psalm 23:4, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. He doesn't deliver us from the valley of the shadow of death. He walks with us through it. I can confidently say that if you embrace your suffering and embrace Jesus in your suffering, he will walk through it with you. He rose from the dead. He's alive, and he's alive to walk with you through your suffering. Thank you.